14. Give yourself a little challenge. George Harrison once decided as a game to write a song based on the first book he saw at his mother's house. Picking one up at random, he opened it and saw the phrase, "Gently Weeps," whereupon he promptly wrote his first great song, "While My Guitar Gently Weeps." You can give yourself the same kind of challenge, whatever medium you work in. Paint only in shades of green. Write a story without using the verb to be. Film a 10-minute scene nonstop with one camera. Giving yourself a handicap to overcome will force you to think in a new and slightly different way, which is the prime goal of scratching. 15. Take a field trip. When scratching turns into frustration, take a walk, but don't just walk anywhere. Add some utility to it. Have a goal. Turn it into a field trip by imbuing the walk with a steely determination to come back with something in hand. If I'm struggling for an idea, I often find myself leaving my studio, walking across Central Park, and ending up at the Metropolitan Museum of Art. Museums are my favorite field trips. And working in museum-rich Manhattan, I would be a fool to ignore the local resources. As Goethe said, "He who cannot draw on 3,000 years is living from hand to mouth." But it's easy to lose yourself and exhaust yourself in a resource as rich as the Met. So you ought to go with a goal. Attack the museum with a purpose. For example, dancers see themselves in a mirror since their first day in a dance studio, and that is often the only way they perceive themselves. I want them to realize new ways of presenting the human body. This is particularly true with dancers new to my company and my work, so I take them to the Met to share some sources that inspire me, and may do the same for them. On one trip to the Met, I started with the 3,000-year-old Cycladic figures, the paper-thin sculptures whose crossed-arm position became the closing image of the fugue. Then it was off to the African wing, where the wooden fertility statues, with their bottom-heavy proportions, hunkering low to the ground, suggest the squatting in my 1998 dance, Yamaya. Finally, we moved to the Egyptian wing to look at an array of striding figures, all locked into the isometric tension that my fierce warriors would need for In the Upper Room. And then, with our minds opened but not overloaded, we were done. In this spirit, the whole world becomes a museum that you can own. Professional musicians are also huge beneficiaries of the world's great resources. They are always traveling to perform, and for them, music is a universal language. If they have ears, a visit to any new musical culture becomes a field trip. Thus, Antonin Dvorak visits Iowa in 1887, and the result is his Ninth Symphony, From the New World, his most famous composition. Jazz pianist Dave Brubeck tours the Middle East in India in 1958, where he becomes intrigued by folk music that doesn't stick to 4/4 time. And the result is his enormous commercial breakthrough, the 1959 album Time Out, with hits like Take Five in 5/4 meter and Blue Rondo a la Turk in 9/8 time. Paul Simon hears recordings of South African street music in 1984, visits South Africa in 1985, and the result, a year later, is his much-admired recording, Graceland. It doesn't matter where you live. If you have a goal in mind, you can turn any venue or destination into a valuable field trip. If you're looking for beauty and sensory relief, it could be a local gallery or a walk in the woods. If you want chaos and exposed human emotions, spend some time in a hospital emergency room or a bus terminal. If you want information, pore over documents in a forgotten archive at your library. If If you want to observe people under pressure, check out a police station or loiter around a construction site. A mall, a blues club, a dairy farm, an open field. They are all worthwhile field trips if you have a clear purpose in mind. It's your world. Own it. Chapter 7. Accidents will happen. The most productive artists I know have a plan in mind when they get down to work. They know what they want to accomplish, how to do it, and what to do if the process falls off track. But there's a fine line between good planning and over-planning. You never want the planning to inhibit the natural evolution of your work. The photographer Richard Avedon is as good at planning and preparation as anyone I know. Before he takes a portrait of a subject, he knows exactly what kind of camera, film, props, and background he will use. Everything is planned ahead. None of his technique is left to chance. Unlike many portrait photographers, Avedon takes preparation a step further and insists on meeting the subjects before the photo session. But all that planning ends at the moment the subject walks into the studio. That's when instinct and creativity take over. Avedon doesn't have a preconceived notion of what he wants the photo to look like, though he does know what feeling it should convey. He plans ahead, but not too far ahead, so he can recognize amazing when he sees it. When he photographed Charlie Chaplin, it was the very day the great comedian was leaving America. He was annoyed, and it showed. He stubbornly refused to give Avedon any emotion other than a blank stare. But there was a split-second moment when Chaplin's theatrical instincts slipped through. Chaplin pointed his index fingers above his head, creating horns, and with his scowl became an angry devil. Avedon believed that a portrait of Chaplin had to have the feel of humor. Equally stubborn and determined, he worked on breaking Chaplin's sullen mood. When Chaplin let his guard down, pretending to be a laughing devil with horns, Avedon snapped. End of photo session. He got what he wanted. A plan is like the scaffolding around a building. When you're putting up the exterior shell, the scaffolding is vital. But once the shell is in place, and you start to work on the interior, the scaffolding disappears.